This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
How bad it gets.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy?
Don't stomp your little last season Prada shoes at me, honey.
John Callio, will you go around with me?
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty, I can't stand it anymore.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Is butter a curb?
I had a hunch you might be a real romantic.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for him.
We could have had a good life together. Fucking real good life. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is broke right now.
You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9, the queerest film show in all the world.
That's true.
Tried and tested. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. And we've got a killer show lined up for this evening.
We do.
Yeah, I'm a little bit nervous. There's a few words
with Daniel and Gina.
I know. We're all going to have to be very.
I can't say it like that.
We're going to have to be very mature tonight.
Yes.
Because we are looking at the way that masculinity is portrayed in films, in cinema, but particularly the way that the male body is used as a locus for, I think, hegemonic masculinity, and those other peripheral masculinities are kind of subordinated to bodies that are not glorified in the same way that certain bodies are.
That's right.
It was quite funny when you mentioned the topic before you went into detail. I was like, oh, masculinity in film, and I went straight to character traits.
Yeah.
And what I see, you know, some of the strongest masculine characters in film, which for me is The Godfather, all three of them. And it's, you know, when I...
Which character in particular, Gina?
Don Corleone. Who teaches us all about masculinity. And there are some famous lines in the Godfather films where he, you know, when one of the kind of smaller characters is breaking down crying and he shakes him, he's act like a man, you know. And for me, that whole epitome of what masculinity is this man who is powerful. And
do you know what? There's probably three of the most destructive words that any boy
just going to say that
can hear, which is act like a man or man up. You know, what does that actually mean?
It's such a noxious phrase.
Yeah, it's putting a horse's head in someone's
bed. And from memory, Don Corleone is really a man of very few words.
Very few words,
and
but
one
very,
of control.
But also he's got this amazing kind of his role as the family man, as the leader, and how important to be the man and the head of the family.
Absolutely.
To protect your family.
But the interesting thing is how bodies are used to reinforce those ideals, and they are, even in The Godfather, they're used. But I think one of the genres that
it was bodies that were dressed, though. Dressed bodies.
That's
heavily suited. Heavily suited and powerful.
That's significant in itself.
Oh, absolutely.
The fact that these bodies are hidden. They are powerful, but they are hidden, whereas the female bodies in films like The Godfather are not.
No.
But I think one of the genres that has a patent on the way that the male body is used as a metonym for masculinity is the superhero genre, which we are in the throes of right now to many people's lament, including my own.
Is it an epidemic? Is it a plague?
So it's something of that kind.
Isn't there something called PAX that's on at the moment? There's some. No, that's gaming.
That's gaming.
Okay,
that's gaming.
That's
For me, the archetypal example is Tobey Maguire in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man franchise, because here he is, this kind of slight, slender, geeky. And then gets bitten by a spider, and the next morning wakes up with this immaculate, muscular body. We are to infer from this body that he is now vested with all the traits of a typical superhero. And he is.
And he is.
And But the funny thing is that audiences, the minute they see that body, they know that he has those powers. They know that he has those abilities. Mm-hmm. So what does that tell us? It tells us that we are kind of taught to see certain traits in certain bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a trick. It's a trick that Hollywood has played on us.
And you know what? Look, it's not just Hollywood. I blame the Greeks.
Ancient
Greeks.
My kin.
It's come through. And I know this is kind of random, David. You know, you're giving me that look.
Alan, but you know my family.
Just occurred to me. This is it's come down to us through our artistic heritage. It's come to us.
My family's actually from ancient Olympia, so watch it. I know my dad looks like that.
But no, there's a whole genre of films that revel in that kind of ancient Greek aesthetic. And that was, I think, recalled and evoked again by Zack Snyder in 300, which you were criticizing.
They were real bodies.
Really? But again, they were cues. They were cues for a certain type of masculinity. Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so...
the hero, the warrior.
It's so lethal.
The indestructible kind of man.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's really toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's something that we're going to be unpacking this evening. And we've got two really, I think, really interesting interviews lined up this evening. The first is with the director of a Brazilian film opening in Melbourne later this week. The film is Neon Bull, and it's an exploration of masculinity and the way that male bodies are used to explore masculinity in film. And I think it's a really powerful film for that reason. But the second interview that we have this evening is an interview with Peter Lehman, who wrote in the early 90s a really critical, seminal exploration of male bodies in film, but also in broader popular culture, called Running Scared. And what that text did was open up, or it was critical, a critical part of opening up a discussion about masculinity in film, in popular culture, and the way that the male gaze is turned on men and is just not talked about, and the kind of consequences that follow from that.
So it'll be interesting to see who's running scared. Is it the straight male? Is it the straight man?
Peter?
Or is it the gay man?
It's
who's running scared?
It's society. It's the great big man in the sky, patriarchal society that is so anxious of seeing a naked man on screen.
Wow. So is Gina at the moment, but that's... It's got to do with my taste more. No.
Okay. So anyway, it's going to be...
No anxiety from me.
None. Mm-hmm.
Well, we are talking masculinity and men's bodies here on Outtakes this evening. You are listening to Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You're on Outtakes with Gina, Alan and Daniel tonight, and we are looking at the way men's bodies is a vehicle for representation of masculinity in film, something I'm completely comfortable with.
Well, so just to summarise that,
yes,
men's bodies.
Bodies.
As a reference to masculinity in film. And you know what? We want to listen to hear from our listeners, to our joysters. We actually want to know what you think is the most notable example of male bodies as a vehicle for masculinity in film.
That's right. So I don't think there's any question.
Hugh Jackman in Wolverine, you know?
Yeah. There's lots of examples. I don't think
there's no question that men's bodies are used as a metonym for masculinity in cinema. The question is, which is the most kind of compelling, which is the most noxious, which is the most attractive.
And has it changed over history, do you reckon? Over our cinematic history.
There's no doubt that action
heroes now.
Oh, if you look at someone like James Stewart, James Dean.
But even how our James Bond characters have changed over the years.
Yes.
From the hidden under the suits and very suave to what we're seeing now is Daniel Craig, usually with his shirt off.
That's right.
Which we've never seen Bond
coming
before.
Coming out of the ocean, very much like Aphrodite.
Yeah.
Well, there's no doubt that there's a trend in cinema that men are being sexualized more. But the interesting thing is that there is, and this is something that Peter Lehman discusses quite a bit in Running Scared, is that there is a clear unconscious political motivation in keeping men dressed in films.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that is this equation of the phallus with the penis. And
we are going to come to that, Daniel. But we need to let our listeners know how they can get in contact with us.
They can message in on 0427JOY949 or email us at onair@joy.org.au and tell us what your favourite, most notable representation of masculinity in film is.
Yes, as in
their
male body form of masculinity, yes?
Are you getting a little bit awkward, Alan?
No. I think you are because you keep on leaving off the fact that they needed to be, we're talking about their bodies.
Sure. Well, yes. Brownie points if you
bodies
can give
and
us
masculinity.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So
moving right along. Moving right along.
We are looking at a film which is about to be released here in Melbourne. It's been doing the festival circuits. It's
doing really well at the
festival. Doing really well on the festival circuit.
Yeah.
And you can see why. This is a really powerful film. The film is, of course, Neon Bull. It's a Brazilian film by director Gabriel Mascaro, and it is an exploration of masculinity. This is about men who are working on rodeos. And rodeo? Oh,
well, it's bulls and horses and stuff. Yeah.
Either
rodeos.
Tomato. Tomato. Okay. Either will do.
But Emir, the main character in this film, has a secret passion for designing dresses for women.
Yeah.
And so the film kind of explores the tension between these two identities as they are within him, within his person. But the film is so interesting because it's kind of observed. The film Mascaro takes a very documentarian approach to this film.
Okay.
So it's really about observing men in their natural environment, which happens to be the natural environment of animals in this film. No, it's really interesting because what he does is he equates Alan.
Sorry, I'm just thinking, what is the natural environment for a man?
Like a ball handler, you know? Who come costume maker.
Okay, yeah. Yes. Now that I've got it out of my system, Daniel, please continue.
Okay. So this is about exploring masculinity, but also exploring the similarities between men and animals or people and animals and asking what is the line between, animal and human. And for me, the film suggests that there isn't much of a line, especially when it comes to bodies and the kind of primal instincts, our kind of primal instincts, and also sexual desire.
Okay. Let's see what the director has to say about that. Yeah.
Okay, well, this is my interview with Gabriel Mascaro. Of course, I asked him what are some of the more notable themes, particularly masculinity in the film, and this is what Gabriel had to say.
Thinking about the country culture, in some way, we always are thinking about the macho, the way of life of these macho cultures connected to the livestock, to the bulls, to the bull riding, the rodeos. A lot of images from the macho culture come to us. Eh? My big challenge was how we can include the macho perspective, but also change and create new possibilities of approach this subject. And in the history of cinema, I think there is a lot of approach about the human body, but the male body is something that in some ways is very hidden, no?
Yeah.
And I try to understand and look to the bodies. How can I reflect in this film about this naturalization of the male perspective and reappropriate this animal environment and very strong environment and bring this to the character. The character is a cowboy that you want to be a fashion designer.
Yeah.
So I try to bring these dual perspectives in the same body.
There's so much there that you've just said, Gabriel, that I want to unpack. But I want to come back to this idea of the male body, which you said, and I think correctly, that it is so often hidden. Why do you think that is?
In some way, the sexist culture is part of our life in our society.
Yeah.
But in some way, the use and the of the female body in the cinema and the others and create something in our culture. Mm. And I try to deconstruct this in Nimbu, where we can look to a very banal, very ordinary way of life of this group of cowboys.
Yes.
So there's a lot of moments where they are spending time, but spending time in these films is definitely something very important to me. They are curating their roots and their space, so it's a road move where the truck doesn't take them nowhere.
The film does kind of revel in that kind of mundane subject matter, but it is so interesting, and I think that's because of the way that you are exploring and unpacking some of these issues. And one of the more interesting issues is the way that the characters in this film, and particularly the men but also the women, are kind of compared to the animals that they're living with, and there's that line between what is human and what is animal that I think you really blur in the film, including in relation to sexual desire.
The point for me was I tried not necessarily say that human and animals are the same, but how can we observe them in the same perspective? So I tried to create some kind of allegory. To me, bull, it's a very intriguing moment, the film where the bull are totally glow in the dark,
yeah.
And sometimes it's some kind of freedom, but sometimes it's a lot of exploitation.
Bulls are regarded as kind of macho animals. What is machismo to you, and how do you think that's represented in the film?
The region where the film is based is very machismo, a lot of machismo, no? But I try to make a film where the characters are not judging themselves, and they are not necessarily reproducing the classical ideas of machismo we understand, no? For example, he's doing his sewing machine, he's trying to do the fashion design, and the other cowboys, they're very natural. When you think about the film, about the cowboy, there is a lot of creation, a lot of projections. So I tried to create a film where we can bring our projections and be faced by something that can be different.
You said earlier that you wanted to challenge the tradition of hiding men's bodies on screen, and in many ways Neon Bull explores men's bodies and the way that masculinity is located in men's bodies.
Yes, for example, there is a lot of films where you can see the use of the female bodies, and I try to how we can observe this male body, observe something that sometimes is totally hidden. The film creates some kind of ritualistic experience of the day-to-day life of this group of cowboys. And I try to understand the rituals of the day-to-day life of these male bodies together. So to observe the having a shower together, something that are totally forgotten because I'm not creating psychological drama. But for me, the film is based in other perspectives where this atmosphere, these talk a lot about how they relate to each other.
What do you think that says about their masculinity and about the way they see themselves as men?
Oh, yes. I try to make a film where this male body, this face day-to-day contradictions of perspectives of the masculine ideas, you know, masculine mindset, what you understand about macho culture. In some way, I think the masculine is put in perspective where we expand the notions of gender understanding, you know?
Yes.
Gender perspective, gender idea of these people. Think about the country culture. In some way, we always are thinking about the macho, the way of life of these.
And I think it's quite deliberate in the use of the animals that are used in this film. I mean, he's not just any old cowboy with cows or whatever. He is working with bulls and horses, and there is actually a scene, quite a deliberate scene where they try and steal horse semen from a stud horse, but it goes wrong.
But that's mirrored at the end with a very explicit sex scene in which Emir features the main character in this film. So again, that comes back to this line between what is animal and what is human, what is particularly male. But the film is really poignant because it does work with imagery in such a meaningful way. Even at the very beginning, there are mannequins strewn across a barren landscape, and I just and all kinds of rags, and I just found that such a meaningful introduction into the film.
Yeah. Look, even check out the preview because it is coming out this week, and you'll start to get a kind of almost that amber kind of CinemaScope kind of just the feel and texture of this film.
It's a beautiful film, and it plays with imagery so well. And I think it is a really timely and meaningful exploration of masculinity
and femininity as well, in the role of the mother that's portrayed in the film.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's what Mascaro was saying in our chat with him before, talking about the way that exploring masculinity in this nuanced way really does expand the parameters of our understanding of gender altogether. So really interesting, and really interesting to think about as well in the context of what we're looking at tonight, which is men's bodies and the way that those bodies are used as tropes for certain types of masculinity. You are listening to Outtakes here on Joy 94.9.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
You're all listening to Outtakes here on Joy with Daniel, Gina and Alan. And tonight we're actually talking about men's bodies and how they serve as a vehicle for the representation of masculinity in film.
You said that better than I did before.
Oh, thanks, Gina. That's because I was practicing.
You were. It was yeah,
and Daniel didn't spring it on you.
No.
Daniel sprung it on you but didn't spring it on me.
No.
But we actually want to hear from our listeners tonight. Yeah. And we actually want to know... what films speak to you in terms of male body and masculinity?
Yeah, what film you think most meaningfully explores masculinity and uses men's bodies as a vehicle to do that? For me, it's Spider-Man, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, and that does tap into a whole broader genre of superhero films. But someone who has written extensively about men's bodies and the way they are used to represent masculinity is Peter Lehman, who in the early 90s published what was a seminal text called Running Scared: Masculinity and the Representation of the Male Body. Now, Peter Lehman is the director of the Center of Film, Media and Popular Culture at Arizona State University.
Yeah, he's still studying. It looks like he's... I did check out the film school's website and he's still a very popular lecturer at Kennedy.
And a prolific writer, too. Yeah, he's published a number of really important texts, edited a number of really important texts, chief amongst them Lady Chatelet's Legacy in the Movies, Sex, Brains and Body Guys. But his work does deal acutely with masculinity and the way it is represented in popular culture, and Running Scared is one of the forefathers, as it were, of the study of masculinity in film. So it was really wonderful to sit down and speak with him and discuss his thoughts on the way that bodies, men's bodies, are used as a vehicle to represent masculinity. Of course, one of his key theories is this idea that there is this great anxiety underscoring the way that we see men's bodies. And this idea that we keep men dressed in films so much more than we do women, because that perpetuates this male mystique and this idea of the male body as a metonym for male power.
And because we need to keep it hidden, because the sheer reality of it
is
a complete deflation. It would totally ruin the mystique.
I'm not going to say that.
So... of course, when I sat down with Peter Lehman, he's been so influential, and my question to him was, what got him into this field? And this is what Peter had to say.
Like for many film scholars of my generation, it was my interest actually in work that began with Laura Mulvey on the representation of women and women's bodies in movies called Visual Pleasure. And it had a profound effect on me, but one of the things that struck me was for all the insight that it brought to things that had been overlooked by film theorists previously, I thought there was an oversimplification about the male body and masculinity, that there was no objectification or eroticization around the male body. And so my interest began actually in relationship to her very important work. And it began not as a reaction, but out of respect for her work and a hope to somehow complement it.
Of course, Mulvey's work was acutely concerned with the idea of men looking at women on screen and somehow enacting a male gaze, but didn't really consider the notion that male gaze could be turned on male bodies too.
In fact, not only could, to me it seemed it inevitably was, that there was a way you could watch movies without also looking at male bodies, and that included all spectators, including heterosexual males, as well as women, and of course, gay men, lesbians, everyone. Everyone had to look at male bodies.
In the text, I suppose, which came out of that interest, Running Scared, one of the central positions is that there is this anxiety around not just viewing the male body, but thinking about viewing the male body.
You know, a common way of that people used to initially think about women in film was that there was a dichotomy that was sometimes called the mother whore dichotomy. And oddly, I found that there was almost something similar going on with men's bodies, which I thought of as either a kind of impressive spectacle of masculinity or a kind of pathetic or comic collapse of masculinity. And there was a tendency to polarize masculinity and men's bodies. And another thing that I found was that there's underlies that. That a lot of people always thought, think of masculinity as, at that time, they thought of it as being a kind of homogenous position of power. And in fact, when you look carefully at masculinity, you see that, first of all, it's not one thing. It's many things, which is why it came to be referred to as masculinities. But those masculinities arise from actually including a great deal of fear and anxiety about being able to live up to the cultural norms of what defines this kind of powerful masculinity. Mm. And one of the things that lies at the center of that cultural norm is a kind of simple notion of the phallus. The phallus refers to a symbolic concept which has come commonly to be thought of as tied to the penis. It's a symbolic concept of power and plenitude that no one ever really possesses.
Do you think, Peter, that film is responsible for the conflation of the phallus with the penis? Did the anxiety then around the representation of the male body conflate those two concepts?
What's interesting is how the history of film, with its changing censorship rules and guidelines in over the years, created a kind of shifting representation of some of those issues. So that, for example, beginning in the late 60s, there was a new possibility for more explicit representation of nudity and sexuality, so that frontal male nudity was possible for the first time in the history of cinema. So you find, and talking about the male body and the male sexuality and the genitals became possible and even commonplace in movies. So some of these anxieties become clear in that. So you have some patterns. And one is, for example, that there's in American movies, there's an incredible popularity to penis-sized jokes. So people are laughing at small penises. Whereas what happens when the penis is visually represented is you get what many people think of as impressive in some way, a part of the visual spectacle. So you get a kind of this polarity that I was talking about, where the spectator is either positioned initially, though as we go along, this will shift, initially positioned to either laugh at small penises that they hear about in jokes but don't see, or to in some way be impressed with the alleged visual spectacle of looking at the penis. And that's tied into other aspects of the spectacle of the body, such as big muscles and powerful-looking bodies and so forth. So I think what happens with films is they certainly bring to the foreground some of these cultural assumptions, but it doesn't come about because of movies. These anxieties are much more profound.
If we take for a moment the proposition that the phallus and the penis are conflated and collapsed, does Hollywood have some interest then in hiding male bodies from view?
That's a very good question. And that's one of the arguments that I try to make, that there's something very ironic that goes on in relationship to the representation of the penis. The traditional assumption of the penis-phallus relationship actually benefits if it's not put in the spotlight. If it's left in the darkness, so to speak, it thrives because there's what mystery does. Mystery is conducive to not only allowing the status quo to continue, but by lending a kind of awe and mystique to the penis, which fits in perfectly with this notion of phallic power, which is kind of a mysterious kind of thing. So not talking about penises and not representing them actually contributes to conventional assumption of a kind of connection between the literal organ and the mystique of this alleged phallic power.
You're on Outtakes here on Joy, and tonight we're talking about the male body and how it's represented as a vehicle for masculinity in film. And just then we had the American academic Peter Lehman talking about masculinity in film and, of course, the representation of the male body, in particular the penis. And, well, and you know what, Daniel, I'm sort of sitting here. I'm sorry to lower the tone, but you know, really, I just think this whole topic for the show this week is just so that we could actually talk about penis. Is that right?
we've
raised it a number of times, and there was just a seven-minute segment.
I've chosen to stick to the male genital region, which Peter does such a good job of explaining its mystification and what it does in making something mysterious and powerful. And, and yeah, I'm not going to say that. Yeah, I'll just stick to that.
And you know what? I totally agree with that because when you actually think about it in terms of mystique, you know, you've got the secret societies around the world and they manage to keep their mystique because they do keep that secret. They do keep secrets and you have to go through a rite of initiation to get in and to reveal that.
For me, one of the really interesting ideas, just picking up on something his was talking about just then, is the conflation of the phallus as this all-powerful symbol of that is the equivalent of the you know, patriarchal culture and society and the power that masculinity so often is seen to represent, the conflation of that with this body part that when it's seen on the screen is very, you know, as farcical. Lehman said, farcical, unimpressive. Mm-hmm. And so Hollywood does have, whether it realizes it or not, a vested interest in keeping men's clothes on.
And he wrote this text, what, over 20 years ago? And we were looking at films that do this now and it's the same. And we're looking at the way they do represent. We were just going through a list of, okay, what are scenes of films where we know full frontal nudity, exact same examples of farce, keeping that mystique. You know?
And this is something else that Lehman talks about, is the representation of males runs along two lines that do not at any point intersect. On one line is the male body as farce, and on the and in queer cinema, that's often been kind of the sissy. Representation of the sissy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what I think is so meaningfully explored in Queer as Folk, the American season, when Emmett is likened to a male eunuch when he goes on TV because there's a farce, we take the sexuality out of the male body. And then on the other side, we have the male body as this powerful, monolithic, inviolable structure.
The archetype.
These are the two archetypes. And I think the best example we have of this is someone like Chris Pratt.
Oh.
Because here was this chubby larrikin who everyone loved, but who never played that role.
In Parks and Recreation.
Absolutely.
He played a chubby chap, and he was unremarkable. Is that right?
Well, he was very remarkable, but just not in the way that Hollywood glorifies masculinity.
Okay. I have to admit, I had to Google image Chris Pratt because he didn't stand out to me as an image like, you know, we kind of talk about the Hemsways and all that sort of stuff. And when I saw his face, and when I did Google image it, there were all these variations of Chris Pratt.
Yeah.
And I recognized him immediately. I just didn't associate his name to it. And I'm sorry, boys, that I missed that. But there is a fascinating article. And if anyone gets the time, in July in Entertainment Weekly, and sorry to give that plug, he actually talks about the work that he went to go from a farcical character into one of these superhero characters and what he had to do to his body in order to be able to play that role, play that masculine stereotype role of losing so much weight in order to fit that.
But I think what that demonstrates is how constructed these ideas actually are.
Huge.
The body is so constructed, and yet we take these as ultimate truths, and that's what cinema teaches us to do. We are exploring the way that men's bodies are used as a locus for masculinity. You're listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes here on Joy 94.9, where we are looking at the way that men's bodies are used as vehicles to explore and represent hegemonic masculinity.
And we have a message. We have a message in from Nick. And Nick has mentioned that for him, one of his favourite, the film that best represents that idea of masculinity in film is Cruel Intentions. He says that Ryan Phillippe didn't have your typical jock body or attitude, yet it showed that he could still be masculine and hot without being a macho jock.
That was like a pivotal part of my growing up, film. Oh, yeah. Ryan Phillippe.
And that's it. I guess Ryan Phillippe's body was very much one that was still in that post-pubescent phase, a twink in, for want of a better word. And yet, you know, it doesn't really characterize that idea that we're talking about today as the man, as the masculine body, as one of being very powerful and monolithic.
And I think
his body wasn't like that.
Well, no, but that was a period of time when there were a lot of those teenage flicks coming out. Yeah. Thank God we weren't seeing boys as those kind of images at that time.
But I think this also supports the proposition that there are many different ways of doing masculinity and many different ways of representing masculinity. And what we're looking at tonight is a snapshot of perhaps the most prolific way of doing that. And that's something that Peter Lehman talks excellently about. Look, but we have asked you to message in and tell us what your favourite representation of masculinity in cinema is. We've had another message in from Richard.
And Richard says that there's a male body representation genre, unfortunately quite unique to the queer community. Mm. And that's the sick gay man dying of AIDS. Mm. Angel in America, Philadelphia, Holding the Man. It's very confronting use of men's bodies on screen and very emasculating in a way.
And that's actually an excellent point, which we will come to later in the program, time permitting. Mm-hmm. But there is this idea that, you know, we've been looking at the kind of monolithic muscular body, but this idea that the body is emasculated that gay men's bodies are emasculated, particularly gay men with AIDS in film. Cinema has a tradition of doing that.
That's true.
And this is just another example of how men's bodies are manipulated on our screens to represent different ideas about masculinity.
Yeah. Mm.
But we have been chatting with Peter Lehman, and we were, of course, chatting before the break about why Hollywood has a vested interest in hiding men's bodies. And this is what Peter Lehman had to say about that.
The way I look at it, what happens is there's a complex contradiction when you begin to show the penis and represent it. So what happens is there become efforts to regulate the penis, because the notion of penises being shown for what they are, which is, in fact, they're not that important, they're not that impressive, they're not that anything. That kind of undermines, you know, this kind of cultural assumption of this significance that we're asked to believe they have. So all these different discourses are kind of careful to establish norms of expectation of what a penis should look like. And my example of that is, in recent years, that has manifested itself more even in very popular cable television shows, as well as in movies. There's a shift now that's going on in male nudity that I think really helps make the point that I was arguing many years ago, which is, if you take a show like Spartacus, which has a lot of male nudity, and it turns out that this has become a new norm, that all the penises are prosthetic. And of course, the only reason to do that is so then the people making what you're watching have total control over what you're seeing. And what you're seeing is always allows them to maintain this regulation.
That comes back to the idea that you were talking about earlier about there being very many masculinities, but really Hollywood does seem to have some stake in representing this hegemonic masculinity, which in many ways centers on the body.
I think so, and I certainly wouldn't want to argue that everyone in Hollywood is invested in the exact same representation of masculinity.
No.
But there's certainly a kind of widespread investment in wanting to promote certain ideas about masculinity, the male body, and male sexuality that are under siege in various ways. For example, women acquiring levels of power that threaten traditional men and traditional masculinity.
That idea has certainly been developed in some of your work, also in work by, I think, Jeffrey Weeks writes quite a bit about it. This idea that the male body really becomes the last kind of bastion of what we might perhaps colloquially call old school masculinity.
Yeah, right. And I think there's a sense in which there's almost a fantasy of wanting to believe that these kinds of bodies either possess this power or this allure, and in the case of heterosexuality, that, like, women really desire these bodies in ways that are of some kind of central and key importance to them for their sexual pleasure and their fulfillment. And you know more about this than I do, but I think that it may play a role as well for some people in relationship to gay culture. It's not as simple as a divide between all straight people and all gay people and things like that.
Of course.
But I think the reality is that even from the point of view now of procreation, penises are no longer necessary for anything in the world we live in. So there's been such a shift in what sexuality and sexual pleasure is about. There can be a very traditional and reactionary aspect to wanting to believe in some kind of incredible importance about the penis and what it means and the place that it has, you know, and its privilege, its alleged privilege.
I do want to come back to an idea that you mentioned earlier, which is found in the work of Laura Mulvey, and that is the idea of the gaze, but broader than that, the idea of actually watching, because once we kind of admit that the male body is so significant, the idea of then watching that has significant ramifications, and I think breaks down some of those distinctions between, you know, homosexual and heterosexual and these ideas around masculinity, because there comes to be some kind of relationship then between the viewer and the viewed.
Absolutely. And I think that heterosexual men have a lot of difficulty even watching, let alone talking about the male body and even saying the word penis. And part of that comes from exactly what you're talking about, which is that even acknowledging that they're looking at, watching, there's a fear in that structure, which is something like, what if I enjoy it? What
yes.
if it gives me pleasure to look at a naked man?
Well, I think Sedgwick calls it knowing proximity.
That's an interesting term. One of the things that I hypothesize about that anxiety that brings us back to where we started this discussion is that I think there's like three levels of it. One is that heterosexual men were afraid of being judged by women. If their bodies were represented in movies, that they're afraid that women will look at them and judge them. And I think the second level of anxiety is the one we're talking about now, that they're afraid that as spectators, they will look at nude men and at their penises, and what if they find it attractive? And then they will be afraid that such a pleasure means they might be homosexuals, and that causes them anxiety. And then the third level is this phallic level we talked about, which is that they become aware that they do not have and cannot have and never will have this mythic phallic masculinity, which is unattainable for anyone. I think that it's riddled with anxiety for the dominant, the kind of assumed heterosexual dominant male that so much of this mainstream representation comes from, which links to fear of women and fear of homosexuals, and then ironically even fear of this phallic masculinity.
I think what was quite interesting in that part of the interview, Daniel, was the idea of how this relates to how gay men feel about their bodies and the relationship between the masculinity portrayed on screen and their own self-image.
Oh, absolutely. And for me, it's particularly interesting to hear him talk about the act of viewing, you know, this this gaze that Mulvey wrote about back in the 70s, really breaking down those sexual categories that we rely on in our society to our detriment, but all the same. That was, of course, my chat with Peter Lehman. We are talking about masculinity this evening and the way that Hollywood represents masculinity through men's bodies. You're listening to Outtakes here on Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You're on Outtakes here on Joy 94.9, and we're talking about masculinity and male bodies in film.
And the way that male bodies are used as a metonym for masculinity.
This testosterone-fueled kind of chiseled...
Well, certainly for hegemonic masculinity, and then the subordinate inverted commas, that's masculinities right. are kind of represented in the less than ideal, shall we say, bodies, which...
often ridiculed.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And I think that what we've been discussing tonight, just briefly to kind of wrap up the show, takes on a particularly noxious... kind of air when you look at the way that that it kind of fits in to the gay community, I think. Mm-hmm. I think there's a particular resonance, which we didn't really touch on in our interview with Peter Lehman, but it can have particularly insidious effects on the gay community. Mm-hmm. And that's something that much earlier in this year, when we spoke to Dwayne Duncan, a researcher at Victoria University, it's something that came up in our chat. You know, gay men, they make up, what is it, 10%, give or take, of the community, and yet 42% of the eating disorder community. And that extends to not just anorexia and bulimia, but muscle dysmorphia as well.
Yeah.
And what that flags is that the images that we are taking in...
Sorry, Daniel, so 42% of men who have got these disorders are gay?
42% of men with body dysmorphia. Okay.
So that's making it very clear that there is a disproportionate relationship there between the actual population and the people who are suffering from these disorders.
And I think that just demonstrates, the way that different audiences interact with different images. And that's something that came up when we spoke to Dwayne Duncan earlier in the year. This is a snapshot of what Dwayne had to say.
Gay men form a readily identifiable group of men who historically have always been associated with ideas around narcissism and who publicly, socially, seem to care about their appearances. So I think the data kind of confirms a pre-established assumption, I think.
I guess the other thing that you kind of bring up is this idea that gay culture or gay men are somehow seen as really having an obsession with beauty and the body.
You know, as I mentioned, there are historical associations between gay men and femininity and narcissism. Mm. But also contemporary gay life is built around a very public expression of sexuality. When you come out as a gay man, it's a very complicated process. You're reflecting on what it means to be gay and what it looks like to be gay. You're coming out as someone different from everyone else, and that involves a lot of reflection on the body. Mm. So what I think is actually occurring is that the body's the site for the expression of a gay identity, both socially and in terms of how we put ourselves forward as a community, but also individually.
You've written, Dwayne, that the athletic body ideal has become central to gay life. How do you mean?
I think it's hard not to participate in any aspect of gay life and see that there's a certain hierarchy around particular bodies and that certain bodies are more esteemed seem to have more social privilege.
And you can catch that interview again with Dwayne Duncan talking body image in cinema on our podcast, and you can catch up on all our shows.
Conrad does a wonderful job at podcasting for us.
Yeah. He does. Thanks, Conrad.
Those podcasts are available on Joy's website. But look, we've dealt with a lot of really interesting themes this evening.
It was a fascinating conversation today.
Absolutely. And I have to thank Peter Lehman. Again, the text is running scared, but Peter has written a number of really influential texts and articles since. And we also need to thank Gabrielle Mascaro, the director of Neon Bull. Neon Bull, of course, opens later this week in cinemas here in Melbourne and also opens in Sydney. So very limited release.
Yeah.
But it's brilliant to see some of these international films on in our art house cinemas.
Well, it's a return from the MIFF season because it was here for Melbourne International
and
Film Festival.
And Sydney International Film Festival too. But that's it for another week of Outtakes.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.